Hi everyone, my name is Kenji. I'm an addict and alcoholic, a human in recovery. And I learned a new term yesterday from Mario Hornbacher. I'm maladaptively unique. Welcome to Bill Schauburg's presentation on what Dr. Silkworth thought about the medical opinion of alcoholism and the early foundations of AA. He's the author of Writing the Big Book, which is an amazing book that I think ought to be required reading for any of us who want to know the real story about how this thing came together back in the 30s. It's an amazing book, and I learned so much from it, and it is such a well-written book. It's as readable as any novel I've ever read, and I totally applaud you, Bill, on your efforts, and with that introduction, which was totally what I feel and believe, over to you, sir.
Thank you, Kenji. And thank you, Joe, for the invitation to come and speak to you today. My name is Bill Schauburg, and I wanted to talk about Dr. Silkworth's solution to the problem of alcoholism, which is really a fellowship-based thing more than anything else. People don't kind of hear it that way. When they look at what Silkworth had to say, if you bother to do that, he talked a lot about moral psychology. But as we're going to see, moral psychology is just translated today. I would certainly translate it today into it's all about the fellowship. So it's frequently said that there are two important elements in Alcoholics Anonymous: the program and the fellowship. And the term in terms of recovery. The main emphasis in AA always seems to have been placed on the program, which included a belief in a God as we understand him. But there are many AA members, including people on this call today, with years and years of successful sobriety who just don't agree with that. So this idea that the key to success in sobriety rests not with a supreme being, but rather with the fellowship to be found in Alcoholics Anonymous, it really has a fascinating, for me, it's just a fascinating, interesting history in the early years of our fellowship before the book was published. So today, I would like to recount some of that early history that emphasized the path to recovery, which focuses primarily on the fellowship. And that story begins with Dr. William D. Silkworth. Now, he's an extremely important player in early AA history. So I'm going to do a little introduction here. Here's our hero for the day here, Dr. Silkworth. He was born in 1873. He graduated Princeton University. He goes and works at the Bellevue Medical School for his internship. He's working in neurology, and he interns in the inebriate clinic. That's fancy language for the drunk ward. During the World War I, we were in the war from 1718. He worked at the U.S. Army Hospital in Plattsburgh, New York, and he was a member of the psychiatric staff there. Following the war, for the next 10 years, he was at Presbyterian Hospital in New York City. He was an associate physician in the Neurological Institute. 29, of course, October 29, the stock market crashes. And Silkworth, I didn't do research on this myself, but I've read by people who have done research that he was basically wiped out in that crash. And he ended up taking over the directorship of Towns Hospital, which was the premier, very fancy, very expensive, what we would today call a rehab. It was the big drying out spot in New York City. It was on, it was on Central Park West. I mean, it was a very tony, high-end place. In 1945, he's not only doing Towns Hospital, he's also doing the Knickerbocker Hospital in New York City. Now, Bill Wilson, in 37, when they have the Counting Noses meeting, he proposes they have a string of hospitals across the country and paid missionaries, and they're going to write a book. And he says, well, we really quickly disabused ourselves of that idea about a hospital, but that's really not true. There was, in fact, a hospital in New York City, and it was an entire floor devoted to the reclamation of alcoholics, and Silkworth worked on that floor, and it was staffed by medical workers, but also by volunteers from AA. I've seen notes, typed up secretarial notes from the Rye, New York meetings in the early 1940s. And they're asking for volunteers to go down and work on the Knickerbocker Hospital floor. Silkworth died in 1951. So just after our first international conference in Cleveland in 1950. So Silberth officially enters the AA story when Bill Wilson made his first trip to Towns Hospital, which was in the fall of 1933. Wilson shows up again. He slips and he starts drinking again badly, and he shows up back at Towns Hospital 9 months later. And then he's hospitalized for the third and final time in December of 1934. It's during the second visit that Bill hears Dr. Silberth explain to Lois how desperate his situation is. This is what Silberth tells Lois. He says, "The biggest fact about alcoholism is its obsessional nature. It is one of the most subtle yet most powerful compulsions known. Once its grip is firm, the chance for recovery is diminished. How to help the alcoholic to expel his obsession is the problem. But we doctors have had little success. I've seldom helped even one case in 100. One case in 100. More important for Silberth's prominence here is when Bill had his white light experience during that final December 1934 visit, and he really thought he was going crazy. He was worried about his sanity. It was Silberth who counseled him by saying, "Look, Bill, something's happened to you, and I don't understand what it is, but you had better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were." Well, Silberth, like Wilson, was a great pragmatist. He was going to take anything that worked. As long as you weren't drinking, that was a very good thing. As my Lord High sponsor said for many, many years, that AA was a pass-fail program. You know, you just don't drink, you pass. That's good. So Wilson spends the next 5 months, he has this white light experience in December of 34, he spends the next 5 months trying to help other alcoholics get sober. And Silberth, he may not have understood what it was that Wilson had, but he did believe that it might be helpful to at least some of his patients. You know, he was only having a 1% success rate, according to what he had told Lois the previous year. So he allows Bill free access to the hospital and to his patients. And Bill's making frequent visits. He doesn't have a job. And he's going to Towns Hospital trying to get these people sober, help get these people sober. But Bill's got no success during the next 5 months. But just before he leaves for Ohio, now this is the famous trip where he goes out to Ohio, Akron, Ohio, and meets Dr. Bob Smith. So he's got 5 months of no success whatsoever. He complains to Silberth really bitterly that he just hasn't been able to get anybody sober. I mean, I've just been burning, you know, time here. I've just been wasting my time. But the doctor says to him, listen, Bill, you got to stop preaching at these people. You know, by this point, Wilson is deeply into the Oxford group. You know, he's doing four absolutes and get on your knees and surrender to Jesus kind of things. So he says, Silberth says, "You got to stop preaching to them and give them the hard medical facts first. That may soften them up at depth so that they'll be willing to do anything to get well. Then they may accept those spiritual ideas of your and even your God." Okay. And in June of 1935, that new approach, Wilson takes it out to Akron, Ohio, and it works perfectly with Dr. Bob Smith. That formula that Silberth gives him works with Dr. Bob Smith. So very much big shout out. Thank you very much, Dr. Silberth. Now, the heart of Silberth's understanding of alcoholism can be found in his diagnosis of the alcoholic's problem and in his belief about the proper solution to that problem. So we're going to be talking about his diagnosis and his solution. Evidence for his opinion on these two important matters can be found in two articles that he wrote for the Medical Record. They were published in April and May of 1937. The book was published in April of 1939, 2 years later. And also, you can find this stuff in The Doctor's Opinion, which was first published in mid-February of 1939. So the first paper is called Alcoholism as a Manifestation of Allergy, and it was published on St. Patrick's Day, 1937. And this is where he offers his famous allergy theory as the proper diagnosis for the alcoholic's problem. What's the alcoholic's problem? Problem is the guy's got an allergy. Got an allergy. And so he says a true alcoholic suffers from this allergy. And it's this condition, which typically, it's something that typically develops over time. But he says, and he also notes that this allergy is similar to the phenomenon of people who have developed hay fever later in life, which I did, by the way. I'm not sure I developed my alcoholism later in life. I may have been born with that, but certainly my allergies cropped up when I got into my 50s. So finally, he notes that just like the hay fever sufferer, this condition never goes away for the alcoholic. Even if a true alcoholic doesn't drink for a year or longer, the full symptomology, the allergy will kick in once he picks up even a single drink. So on that level, Silkworth is definitely on the same page as Alcoholics Anonymous and Bill Wilson was. But when we get to the doctor's opinion, that Silkworth puts much more stress on the major symptom related to this allergy. So we really got two factors here. We got an allergy, but how do you know you got an allergy? Well, you got these symptoms. If you got these symptoms, then you got the allergy. And the symptoms are namely that when a chronic alcoholic picks up the first drink, the phenomenon of craving immediately kicks in and drinking becomes paramount to all other interests. Okay, been there, done that. Silkworth explains why the alcoholic picks up that first drink in some of the most famous words in the doctor's opinion. He says, men and women, why do they pick up the first drink? Men and women drink it essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once from taking a few drinks. I think it's important to note here that Silkworth's diagnosis of the alcoholic's basic problem, that once he starts drinking, he can't stop, is most certainly a valid observation and one of the most obvious hallmarks of alcoholism. Regarding this allergy theory, this is what Bill Wilson has to say when he introduces this letter from the doctor, this section in that thing from the doctor in the doctor's opinion. He says, Wilson says, the doctor's opinion that we have a kind of allergy to alcohol, it interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-alcoholics, they were using that phrase back then, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. So 5 weeks after that first article, a little bit more than a month, he publishes a second article, Reclamation of the Alcoholic. And so in this article, he details his proposed solution to the alcoholic's problem. And the revolutionary element here, he insists that you got to have the proper withdrawal, proper medical treatment that goes with that. But the revolutionary element is that once you've gone through those proper medical treatments, that the prolonged recovery from alcoholism depends on the adoption of moral psychology. Silkworth believed that moral psychology was the solution to the alcoholic's problem, because he believed that it brought about the essential psychic change, that's a quote, needed for the alcoholic to stop drinking and to stay sober. And I just always think it's fascinating to note that these two articles that he published in 1937 with his secular understanding of the disease, both the diagnosis and solution, coincided almost perfectly to the week with New York group. They broke from the Oxford group in April or May of 1937, just as these articles are being published. Now, of course, I'm sure most people know that the Oxford group was a dogmatic Christian fellowship that introduced a large dose of religion into early AA, much of which we still have in later AA. But certainly this break with the Oxford group is one of the most important and impactful events in early AA history. So Silkworth's articles coincided with the New York group stepping away from the Oxford group in April or May of 1937. The Akron people did not distance themselves from the Oxford group until December of 1939. Different things going on out in Akron. So this belief in moral psychology as a solution to alcoholism also appears very briefly, but without any explanation in the doctor's opinion. Silkworth mentions moral psychology twice in the doctor's opinion. So here's the couple of quotes we're going to go through. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. And blah, 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 blah. Okay, so you got to have some moral psychology here. But we don't know how to bring it about. And he said, talking about one of his patients at the end of the doctor's opinion, he says his alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only help would be to go through what we then called moral psychology. And we doubted if even that would have any effect. But there's no further explanation in the big book other than that moral psychology is this critical element in getting people sober. And why is it a critical element? Because without the moral psychology, you don't get this essential psychic change that you gotta have. That's like you got just got to get that essential psychic change. So in Silkworth's view, the point of this moral psychology is to bring about the essential psychic change needed for the alcoholic to stop drinking and to stay sober. But what the devil is that? What is that essential psychic change? That phrase shows up three times on a single page in the doctor's opinion. He says, after alcoholics have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, back to the allergy, they pass through the well-known stages of spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless that person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who don't understand, once the psychic changes occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that he required to follow a few simple rules. Well, what are we shooting for here in Silkworth's world? The essential psychic change. That's what we need. And then finally, he says on that same page, one feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. He's easing his way over into Bill Wilson land there. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychic effort is considerable, we physicians admit that we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. So that's what he's talking about in the doctor's opinion. But again, like, what is this moral psychology? It doesn't explain it at all. So in this article that he wrote, the second article, Reclamation of the Alcoholic, there's four major sections and on how to actually treat alcoholics. But the last one of those is boldly entitled, last of four sections, is called Moral Psychology. It's a big title on it, just like that. And here's what it says. Moral psychology, let's find out what this is. Moral psychology, we believe that this decision is in the nature of an inspiration. The patient knows he has reached a lasting conclusion and experienced a sense of great relief. Guy's hit bottom. He's down there. He's ready to do anything. These individuals, introverts for the most part. Now, I think that's a little bit of a misuse of the way we use the word introverts these days. Introverts are, I think of an introvert as somebody who's off in the corner and very quiet by themselves. That's not what Silkworth's talking about. These individuals, introverts for the most part, whose interests center entirely in themselves. Oh, introverts are people who can't pay attention to anybody but themselves. That's what he's talking about. Once they have made their decision, frequently ask how they can help others. Moral psychology is about getting your head out of your butt and paying attention to other people. And he gives us two case histories. This one is close to Hank Parker's. He says, following a thorough elimination and medical rehabilitation, the medical stuff we got to go through, he made a satisfactory physical recovery. He then took up moral psychology and in 2 years' time has entirely recovered his lost fortune and has been elected to a prominent public position. On meeting this patient recently, we experienced a strange sensation. While we recognized the features, a different man seemed to be speaking, as if a self-confident stranger had stepped into this man's body. Took up moral psychology, huge transformation. And the next case is clearly Bill Wilson, following the course of treatment in which the alcohol and toxic products were eliminated and his craving counteracted, he took up moral psychology. That's what Silver says Wilson did. He gave part of his income to help others in his former position and has gathered around him a group of over 50 men. We're talking fellowship now, people, all free from their former alcoholism through the application of this method of treatment and moral psychology. Silkworth then concludes this second article with a single short paragraph advocating for his solution and praising the men of Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, to such alcoholic patients, we recommend moral psychology. And in those of our patients who have joined or initiated such group, the change has been spectacular. So just to be clear, Silkworth's saying that for an alcoholic to recover, they have to stop being centered entirely in themselves and instead begin asking how they can help others. In short, join the fellowship. It was Silkworth's understanding of the solution that Hank Parkhurst had gradually adopted as his own belief about the proper paths of sobriety. Hank's my number one hero. I'm sure a number of people here, anybody who's read my book, know about Hank Parkhurst, because he's probably the after Bill Wilson, certainly the most important person in that book. This was a path based on what was then called this moral psychology, which today we would more easily understood as fellowship, I think. So on May 20th, 1938, 2 years after Dr. Silkworth's two articles appear, Bill Wilson starts writing the first two chapters of the big book. He writes, there is a solution. It was originally called Chapter One and Bill's Story. Now, because writing his own story was far less challenging than there is a solution, because let's face it, Akron was still deeply involved in the very, very, very Christian Oxford Group movement, while New York had already begun shifting into a much more inclusive model. So rather than jumping right on, there is a solution. First thing he writes is Bill's story. But once he's finished with that, then he's got to move on to the first draft of There Is a Solution. And his right-hand man in New York, Hank Parkhurst, was not happy about what he was seeing and hearing Bill writing, because this was happening in his office in Newark, New Jersey. Most especially, he thought that Wilson was writing was way, 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 way too religious. He was advocating for a book based on moral psychology, not a religious solution, a moral psychology solution. It was exactly the kind of solution, a psychological solution, that Hank was suggesting Bill should be emphasizing when he was writing There Is a Solution. After all, he says to Bill, that was Soper's solution, wasn't it? What's the problem? Why are we going off into all this deep religious stuff? And so the arguments began. This is really, really, in my opinion, one of the most incredibly important arguments in the whole early history of AA. It's going to go on between Bill and Hank from June of 1938 right up until April of 1939, when the book was finally published. This argument about religion versus psychology. Now, Wilson talks about that in When AA Comes of Age. He talks about religion versus, they wanted a psychological book. And the first time I read that, I thought, oh, they wanted a book based on Freud's theories, or they wanted a book based on Jung's theories. But that's not what we were talking about. What Parkhurst was talking about was moral psychology, and it was Silver's theories. Nothing really has more impact on the final text of the big book, in my opinion, than this particular running argument from June 38 to April 39. Hank couldn't really call into question what Bill put in his own story. It was autobiographical. But when it came to There Is a Solution, he offered Bill an 11-page handwritten document with his suggestions for what he thought should be going into that chapter. Bill titled that document Hank's Idea. So both men are writing. Bill's working on the first vision of There Is a Solution, and Hank's jotting down his ideas about what that chapter should and shouldn't say. It was 11 handwritten pages, and this was page one. That's Hank's handwriting, except for at the bottom, Hank's ideas is Bill's handwriting. So it's a wonderful, wonderful little snapshot of what's going on in New York City in Alcoholics Anonymous in June of 1938. The very first line that confirms the timing, chapter one, which was There Is a Solution, is being dictated. So we're talking about the first week of June 1938 here. It's early June of 1938, and Parkhurst is about to launch his first attack of many on Bill Wilson and the program of recovery that he's crafting to present to the world. And it's just going to go on and on and on and on and on for months here. He says, if Bill, if you're going to explicitly explain their solution, then the solution should not be so religiously oriented. Instead, it should emphasize moral psychology as the primary solution to the alcoholic's problem. And this was 11 pages long. These are three pages I think are the most important. This is really where he gets down into his argument with Bill. Observations, page 8. One of the easiest and most talked about things among us is a religious experience. I believe that this is incomprehensible to most people. Simple and meaningful words to us, but meaningless to most people who we're trying to get this over to. Simple and meaningful words to us, but meaningless to most people that we are trying to get this over to. In my mind, religious experience, religion, etc., should not be brought in. We are actually irreligious. How about that for a characterization of one man's opinion on what's going on in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1938? We are actually irreligious, but we're trying to be helpful. Moral psychology. We have learned to be quiet, to be more truthful, to be more honest, to try to be more unselfish. Moral psychology. To make the other fellow's troubles our troubles. Moral psychology. And by following four steps, we most of us have a religious experience. The fellowship. Moral psychology, the unselfishness appeals to us, moral psychology. He says, I wonder if we're off track. A very good merchandising, Hank was a businessman, procedure is to find out why people do not buy our products, and it's good reasoning to find out why. I am fearfully afraid that we are emphasizing religious experience when actually that is something that follows as a result of 1, 2, 3, 4. In my mind, the question is not particularly the strength of the religious experience as much as the improvement over what we were. Moral psychology. I would ask a man to compare himself as follows after, say, a month. So here's Hank's plan. Guy's been sober for a month. He's been doing moral psychology. He's sober for a month. And Hank says, you want to ask these guys four questions. as compared to 2 months ago when you were drinking? Do you have more of a feeling that there's a power greater than you? This is a developing thing that comes out of moral psychology. Number two, have you cleaned out more completely than a human with a human being than ever before? Number three, have you less bad things behind you than ever before? And number four, have you been more honest with yourself and your fellow man? Moral psychology. Have you been thoughtful of people with whom you are associated? Moral psychology. Has your life been clearer, both by thought and action? Have you looked at others less critically and yourself more critically these past 30 days? You will never be perfect, but the question is, have you been more perfect? So the essence of this argument, as I understand it, between Bill and Hank, is that Bill believes that you must first have a vital spiritual experience in order to start living a life that is then based on moral psychology. Whereas Parkhurst believes it happens exactly the other way around. Practicing moral psychology for starters is going to result and give you a spiritual awakening. So they're both talking about the same thing, but they're talking about it happening in a completely different sequence with a completely different emphasis. Bill was not completely insensitive to these suggestions, but rather than eliminating his very pointedly religious slant of the text, he began to blend Hank's perspective on moral psychology into There Is a Solution and into the chapters that follow. Now, so this is May, June of 1938, very first start of the writing for the big book. Bill believes that moral psychology was an essential feature for the program of recovery, so he could easily concede to Parkhurst's pleas by including a strong emphasis on moral psychology into what he was writing in that month. So here's just out of Bill's story. You know, we're looking to be useful. And Bill's story, you got to be usefulness to others. And I want to help some of those people and self-sacrifice for others. And the idea of helping other alcoholics. And in There Is a Solution, sincere desire to be helpful. This would suggest a useful program and attitudes which make us more useful to others. Our constant thought of others and how we may help to meet their needs. This incorporation of Hank's insistence on the importance of moral psychology to sobriety continued throughout Bill's writing of the rest of the book. And any careful reading of the first 164 pages will reveal no less than 72 explicit references to the importance of being useful and helpful to others. Hank's moral psychology is right there in the big book. It's in plain sight. You just got to be looking for it. Don't get blinded by that God stuff. There's other things going on there. Unfortunately, Bill Wilson never gave up his insistence on the necessity of belief in a potential providential supreme being as the key element necessary to any real recovery, most especially because it was an integral part of his own diagnosis, different from Silkworth's, and solution, different from Silkworth's, of the problem of alcoholism, which he offered in these two earliest chapters. While Silkworth diagnosed an allergy that flared up once the alcoholic started drinking, Bill pushed the problem much further back in time, and he brilliantly, in my opinion, genius brilliantly, diagnosed the alcoholic's basic problem as having no defense against the first drink. The problem wasn't that once you started drinking, you couldn't stop. I mean, we know about that phenomenon of craving. Sure, we're not denying that, but there's a problem that exists before you even pick up the first drink. That's where the problem is. That's Bill Wilson's diagnosis of the problem, the alcoholic's real problem. Bill's proposed solution is also similar to Silkworth's, but it was much more spiritually specific. He says you needed to get yourself a vital spiritual experience. And Bill clearly understood spiritual as something you can only get through a direct personal relationship with a providential God. One of the things I know I talk about in the book is, you know, spiritual equals God and God equals spiritual. And by the way, when we're talking about God, we're talking about a God you can pray to and get help from for those prayers. A providential God. So despite its strong and prestigious early support, this idea of recovery through other people, moral psychology, or what I think is more easily understood certainly by me today as fellowship, was relegated to a decidedly secondary place in the recovery movement. And it still remains so to this day in the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous. Even Wilson's mention of moral psychology and the fellowship in the book, they always came with a very, very strong Christian slant to them, always. I mean, when he was talking about that kind of thing, he was always talking about, it was always tinged with this idea of self-sacrifice and doing for others no matter what the personal cost to you might be. That kind of language has prevented far too many people from from ever seriously considering living their life within a vibrant fellowship. The packaging that the idea of moral psychology came with was just too Christian. The packaging for the idea of a vibrant fellowship was just too self-sacrificing, too doing for others and not for me. It was just something that turned way, way, way too many people off. But still, there are hundreds of thousands of people staying sober in AA today based primarily on their participation in the fellowship they have found there. I was certainly one of those people. Now, there are many, many different ways to understand the benefits of fellowship without wrapping it into such an obviously Christian or religious context. And so let me offer my own understanding of this. I'm not quite sure how much this will resonate with the rest of you, but this is what works for me, okay? And there are so many different ways of approaching this. My way of understanding, a very much more secular understanding of fellowship, and why I think it's such an important part of sobriety, and I note this is very personal perspective, may not appeal or even make sense to many, but it's an important element of my own understanding and acceptance of a communitarian way of life. Very, very much dedicated and deeply embedded in a communitarian way of life, and I have been for the past 40 years. I'm a student of what's called big history. Big history is a study of history from the Big Bang to the present. It was invented by a man named David Christian in Australia in 1989. He's written a fabulous book on it called Maps of Time. And it's just the broadest perspective you could possibly have on history. It's called Big History. And his history book literally starts with the Big Bang and goes through the formation of the universe and takes us all the way up to the present. Human beings don't show up until chapter 23 or something. So when we get to that, I've learned that our species, Homo sapiens, has been on this planet for a very, very, very short time. We've only been around for 250,000 years, a quarter million years. Now, that may sound like a long time to a lot of people. I mean, it's a quarter million years. It is a long time. But on a cosmic level, it's barely the blink of an eye. I mean, the Big Bang is 13.7 years ago. If the 13 billion years since the Big Bang, we're just going to repackage them so we can get a little bit of perspective here. If you imagine those 13 billion years to be just 13 years, human beings arrive on this planet in the 13th year on December 31st at 10 minutes to midnight. We've been around for 50 minutes of those 13 years. That's how recent we are. Now, the most important thing to this question of fellowship, in my opinion, is that we were clan people. We were hunter-gatherers for the past 240,000 years of our time on that planet. So for 96% of our history as a species, we've lived our lives embedded. We were deeply, deeply, deeply embedded. We didn't see ourselves, conceive of ourselves. We didn't experience ourselves as the separated individuals we are today. We were deeply embedded in nature, and we were deeply embedded in a small group of human beings that we were a part of. And those human beings had banded together for their safety and for their protection and so that they could flourish in this life. That means that the need to belong to some group in order to properly thrive in this life was built into our psychological DNA for the first quarter million years of our species existence. I find that profoundly thought-provoking. It's something that I pay attention to with real regularity. What happened? 10,000 years ago, we started abandoning the hunter-gatherer way of life. We started leaving the tribe. We started leaving the clan. We started leaving those people, and we started farming, which is a much more individuated family kind of project. And that led to a breakdown of our embeddedness in the group. And then 5,000 years ago, cities began to spring up, 3000 BC. And that further divorced us from the group and created more and more individuation. So there's an evolution of individuation that's going on in our human species, and we're in the middle of it today. If you don't think that all the digital stuff going on isn't changing our sense of our own individuation, I don't think you're paying attention. But anyhow, this is just me. In short, our species has recently moved from a radical they made a radical move from being a part of. 240,000 years, we were a part of, we were deeply embedded, we were a part of. And now we're separate from. Today we live in a culture and a society that claims autonomy is its highest virtue. I've never been to a therapist or a psychologist who didn't think his job was to make me a more autonomous human being. The best therapist we ever found, we never talked about AA with him because he thought that was a sign of dependence, and dependence was a bad thing. He was always all about autonomy. He wanted me to be able to stand on my own two feet and not have to listen or talk to any other people whatsoever. And that's true of our culture, most especially our American culture. I would like to suggest that the autonomy is not the solution. Autonomy is the problem. It's a big problem. And that the fellowship of AA, in my opinion, offers a perfect antidote to this problem of separateness and alienation. I think it's one of the reasons why I've always felt very, very, very comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous, being a part of. I believe that the Fellowship of AA is an amazingly powerful tool, and it's one that offers people the opportunity to get re-embedded in humanity, allowing them to flourish and live in a much fuller and richer life within a community of people who share a common identity and a common purpose. So that's just my understanding of why fellowship is such a critical element in any plan to build a rich and flourishing life. But whatever your own path to fellowship might be, I would encourage you to follow it diligently. Staying sober together. That's what I think we're doing here. Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot, Bill. And I'd like to now open it up to questions and comments. Please raise your digital hands, and I'll call on you in the order that you raised your hands. And while waiting for the first hand, let me comment on towards the beginning of your talk where you were talking about the allergy. I came in with a go-fast drug problem. Alcohol was also a problem, but I was not focused on that. I was focused on the stimulant drugs, which brought me to my knees. And when I came in and I heard that you're an alcoholic, if when you take that first drink, you cannot stop drinking. And I don't think I've ever had that experience, but I've had that exact experience around the drugs, and in a way around the drinking, because I could probably have a cocktail or a glass of wine with dinner in a nice upscale restaurant, and I wouldn't make a fool out of myself. I'd finish my dinner, I'd go my way, but then I'd go right out and cop drugs and be on a run that I could not stop. I have a disease, and I guess it could appear differently depending on my exact drugs of choice, but it seems like the disease of addiction is what he's describing there. It doesn't just apply to alcoholism. What do you think about that?
PG, that's a great question. I've got a little bit yes and no opinions on this whole allergy thing. I mean, I've got a really good friend who's been sober, I don't know, 20, 25 years these days. And he just hates when people talk about the allergy because he claims he gets all medical on it and he says it doesn't really fit the model. And he goes off on that whole thing, you know, and he's right on one sense. I understand what he's saying. You know, his objection, I think his objections are valid. But on the other hand, when I first came in and they said, listen, if you were allergic to strawberries, would you be eating strawberries every night? And that made perfect sense to me. Just absolutely drop dead perfect sense to me. So if it's not accurate language from a medical point of view, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that because I would hate to give up a newcomer's reaction as I had as a newcomer when somebody said all you got to do is hit that strawberry analogy. And like, you know, like the scales fell from my eyes. You know, I couldn't argue about it anymore. I didn't go right into, well, you know, this doesn't really meet the standard medical definition that you're going to find today of an allergy. And by the way, let's just talk about the strawberries and we'll all be happy. Stop drinking. We want you to stop drinking. And if it helps you stop drinking, then we're good. Bill Wilson was the supreme pragmatist. That's all he cared about was what was going to help you stop drinking. And I find that particular analogy works for me. So I know there's a giant controversy around that, but I just don't tend to go there. William James, one of my favorite writers, William James talked about the cash value of our ideas, you know? What's the cash value? If you say, you know, I for instance, let's just say you believe in God, but you do these really dreadful things, then your beliefs don't have any cash value. And I think the whole argument about allergy being, you know, the wrong medical term is doesn't have a lot of cash value. Strawberries, the strawberry allergy has a lot of cash value to it. It certainly did for me when I came in. So I'm going to stick with that.
And Janice, you're next up.
I'm Janice. I'm an alcoholic. This is very interesting because I listened to something yesterday, part of one where I've forgotten who the guy was. He's a neuropsychologist. I'm talking about that, yes, it is sort of an allergy if you think that dopamine, which is pretty much what they think is the cause of all our problems in our brain, is kind of like drinking can trigger that if you have the predisposition and everything else. Whether that's true or not, for me, the idea that Silkwood said an allergy back in 1937, 8, whatever, was amazing because nobody had thought of, you know, everybody thought it was a character flaw and all that kind of stuff. Of course, plenty of people still think it's a character flaw. But I'm an atheist, and I was when I came in the doors, and I was where there was no secular where I was at the time. I had, you know, I wasn't sure this was going to work, but I did what I was told, and I slid through 2 and 3 with a agnostic sponsor. But what I have found, what I put in place of God, partly the group of drunks, which I consider the fellowship of AA, and service work with the fellowship because it gets me out of myself, which is what I think you're saying, sort of. And, you know, just staying close to the program. I don't know how many meetings I've been the token atheist in, but I will speak up because I don't want somebody to come into this program and leave before they find the parts of the program that work for them. And I'd like your take on that.
Thank you. But people who haven't seen my book, the first chapter is called Challenging the Creation Myths. And then there's 30 chapters after that. And each one of those chapters bangs and beats up at least one AA creation myth story that just doesn't get supported by the documentation. When I wrote the book, my wife and I talked all the time about, you know, the incendiary reaction we expected from a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it wanders so far off the traditional hallowed stories that Bill Wilson told on many occasions, not all the time, but a lot of times. I used to say jokingly when the book came out, they were going to buy 20 copies and burn them on the front lawn of Dr. Bob's house, you know? So far as I know, that hasn't happened. But people don't typically come at me directly and complain. There's a couple of snarky things that show up on Amazon in customer reviews. But the problem I think that most people have, and I wrote the book with this very, very much in mind, the problem they have is that my book is a scholarly, well-researched project. I spent 11 years researching, and the last 7 of those years I was writing simultaneously. And the book has 416 informational footnotes and 1,570 endnote citations. So if you don't agree with what's in the book, let me see the document. I just want to see the document. People have shown me documents that disagreed. I said at one point in the book, in the first edition of the book, I said that Dr. Bob, the earliest I could find him being called a co-founder was 1947. Well, within several months, people started sending me stuff. And 2 people sent me things that showed late 1942 and early 1943 things where he was being called a co-founder. Now, they were a little strange and weird at the time, but they're right. They were right there. And quite frankly, I love it when people find things that I didn't find, and they unearth facts that I just wasn't aware of when I wrote my book. The whole thing, we're in this massive process, you know, of trying to get a little bit closer to what really happened. I think that's the historian's job. You're never going to get there to what really happened. But I think that was certainly my project and what I was trying to do when I wrote that book. But you know, we're human beings, and we're talking about 80 some odd years ago. You know, my wife, the lady Sarah, and I can't agree on something that happened last week, for God's sakes. We were both in the same room. So, you know, this is it's a difficult thing. And I'm not saying that what I wrote in my book is gospel truth, but it's the best shot I had at the time. And I'm always looking for people who can straighten me out and tell me I got something wrong. Because we the project is to get closer to what really happened. You know, it's not to prove Bill Shaver just got it all right, because that's not the case.
Yeah, I guess the biggest myth that you exploded was the idea that the book was written by 100 people.
I think that's one. I love the fact that Ebby's story of the kitchen table story is so radically, completely, totally different from that hallowed story that Bill Wilson told. I think the most explosive thing in my book is the fact that the whole six-step story, oh, we had six steps, and then I took them all apart, and I pulled them apart and got into 12 steps, is the big, I mean, the first time I can, I wish somebody would find something sooner. The first time I can tell that anybody talked about six steps was when Bill Wilson gave a speech in Montreal in May of 1949, 10 plus years after he supposedly wrote the 12 steps. And it was just, it was painful for me to think that he had just made this freaking story up. And there's reasons for it. And then, I mean, that's chapter 23 in my book. And it took me 6 months just to put that down on paper, because it was such a difficult thing for me to figure out what the hell was going on. But I don't think it's the 100 guys. I think that's always been pretty much seen by a lot of people as being an exaggeration at best. But Wilson wrote the book. There's no doubt in my mind that Bill Wilson wrote the book, and the documentation from the time shows that very, very clearly.
Dave, hello. Come on in.
Can we look at the other branches of our family tree? There's clanship and groups, you know, embedded in virtually all of it. You don't find too many solitary monkeys. So I think, you know, our need for fellowship goes back way deeper than just the evolution of Homo sapiens. I love hearing about Hank Parkhurst. One of the ways as one of the more vocal local atheists that I kind of weed my way into the traditional meetings I go to is I try to relate stuff that's being talked about to the early history of AA, the real one, not the fables that we tell ourselves in the traditional meetings often. And it's amazing how many people aren't even aware of Hank Parkhurst, who as you've mentioned, you know, really instrumental in the writing of the book. You know, it's just, you know, him and Jim Burwell and the push and pull against the religiosity of the book. I think, you know, a lot of that religiosity was partly Bill's history of, you know, he's a white Christian male in the mid 1930s, and part of it was, you know, he was trying to get the Akron groups to buy into what was being written, and they were intensely religious, you know, for long, long time. I mean, just read Dr. Bob's story in the Big Book. The unfortunate last two paragraphs of that story is kind of a dead giveaway to that. But as you've mentioned, I found that, you know, the longer I'm sober, the more I can read the Big Book and kind of dive underneath the surface there and ignore the more religious parts. And there's a lot of really wisdom and good truth in what Bill had to write. And I'm sure a lot of it was, you know, with the help of Hank. You know, unfortunately, Hank decided to go back out again after the book was published. And so he's been partly written out of AA history as a result of that. And he deserves to be brought back into greater relevance today. So thanks again for this really interesting talk.
You're welcome. You know, Hank is vilified because he supposedly didn't believe in God and he drank again. So that just proves that you got to believe in God, you know, but who was the big slipper and slider for the first 15 years of the program was Ebby Thatcher. And Ebby Thatcher was a big Oxford group guy. He lived for a year and a half in a Christian community over in New Jersey, drinking all the time throughout the very late 30s and into the early 40s. And so why don't we vilify that God stuff, because Ebby wasn't working for Ebby, for God's sakes, you know. Anyhow, get off that little podium. Thank you.
Thanks. John, hello. Come on in.
You brought a lot of thoughts to mind, and as far as the fellowship keeping me sober, and I realized after some time that that's really what has kept me sober is the fellowship, because I never really believed in God. I never really thought about it too much before I got to AA. I mean, I was brought up in going to church and stuff, but I never just had felt any connection. So I was in AA for about 5 years, and I ended up drinking again. And when I came back 5 years later, you know, I crawled back to AA, and I really needed to, for the first time, I saw that God of your own understanding. And so I really needed to have an understanding of, you know, what power is keeping me sober. And a lot of it comes down to the fellowship of AA. You know, not any people in particular. You don't want to put people on a pedestal, but the program, the fellowship, and service work has really kept me sober right from the beginning. You know, getting involved. And right now I'm the PI committee in my area. I'm in South Carolina right now in the Bible Belt. And I'm afraid they're going to kick me out of AA because I know, you know, I'm not Christian. But at any rate, that's my little spiel. But I just wanted to ask you a quick question. I haven't started reading your book yet. I'm just, somebody suggested reading Not God. And so I'm trying to finish that. It's a real snoozer. I read a review for your book. One of the reviews is from the wife of Kurtz. Uh-huh. And Linda. She says your book is better than his. And I was wondering, does she not like him anymore? Or is it a genuine review?
John, that's funny. I've never been asked that question before, but it does kind of jump out at you. The very first critical review of the book was by Linda Kurtz. Ernie's dead. Ernie died in January of 2015. And he was very much a mentor for me. Twice I got on a plane and flew up to Michigan. It was in Ann Arbor, and spent a couple of days with him. And Linda was always there. Linda's just a great person. She's written some serious, powerful stuff. Her last book was published by Oxford University Press. But she, you know, I think the problem, you're right. Ernie's book can be a little bit turgid, let's say, at times. You know, it just slows down at times. And I've been complimented by a number of people. And I think Kenji just said something about it when he introduced me, was that it's an easy read. You know, it's I've had people tell me it reads like a detective story. I don't think I could have a higher compliment than that it reads like a detective story. So Linda liked the book. There's no doubt about it. And she was very, very complimentary from the start. So thank you. But she loved Ernie too. They were very much an in-love couple. They were really, really great. Really great. And she still is. She's on my to-do list. I got to call her. I haven't talked to her in a while.
You know, the only thing I'd say about your book, Bill, is that I have the Kindle edition of it, and I think I'm probably going to buy the paperback version. I'm a big Kindle reader, but unfortunately, with all the footnoting and endnotes, the Kindle system doesn't do well with jumping to a footnote and then jumping back to the text. Especially the endnotes. If I go to the endnote to read that stuff, I have trouble getting back to where I was in the text. So that's my only advice to people is this is one book, if you're a big ebook fan, that if you want to be able to read the extensive notes, many of which are whole mini stories unto themselves, they're not just merely citations, that you might want to get this one in the Dead Tree version. Mikey B, who's auditioning to be cover art for you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Ken G. I want to thank you, Bill, so very much for this wonderful book and all the work that you put into it. I definitely attribute my sobriety more to the fellowship than to the book Alcoholics Anonymous. In the beginning, when I first got sober, I started reading the big book. The doctor's opinion was something that was very important and made lots of sense to me. Chapter 3 made lots of sense to me. You know, those, I found those to be very important, you know, the definition of alcohol and the experience of alcoholics. I could relate to that. In meetings, I could hear stories of other recovering alcoholics, and I can get that hope that we need to get from that community, from our tribe, if you will. This book here, I have both the Kindle and the large book. I'm reading it on the Kindle, but I find the same issue that Kenji did with the Kindle format. So I have the book also. So that kind of speeds things up, because jumping back and forth and reading notes is a problem. That's not anything to do with you. That has to do with the formatting. I find it, I don't read 780 page books generally, but this one came so highly recommended by some of the people on this secular Zoom meetings that I wanted to get it. I love the history. I was a member of our area archives for a number of years, and we regularly would go to conventions, and we had the traditional AA approved archives presentations. You know, would have things like the masked men, you know, talking about their, you know, newspaper articles,
yeah,
from the past, where, you know, that was all about anonymity and stuff. But, you know, a lot of this stuff, I tried to figure out who was the agnostics, who were the atheists, and who were fighting, and how much Bill wrote, and how many the 100 people were. And I knew that it was mostly Bill. I didn't know how much influence Hank Parkhurst had on this, or Ebby, but certainly their history through AA approved materials has pretty much been pretty much almost erased or sidetracked. Fantastic that I get to hear the other voices. I particularly wish that I'm up to Hank Parkhurst's notes and stuff in your book. And I wish the book would have been written by him instead of Bill, because the God stuff never made any sense to me. But I put up with the, you know, I stayed sober on traditional Alcoholics Anonymous, and just pretty much used what I could and ignored the rest and faked the rest to get along with everyone. Thanks, Bill, for letting me share.
Thank you. And by the way, you know, Hank wrote to employers, but he also wrote a thing called the Q&A chapter, if you haven't gotten that far in the book. And that's by the way, some people, you need to know that the hardback copy has 80 pages of appendices. There's 10 appendices in the back. When we went to the paperback copy, we dropped the appendices because everybody was claiming the book was just too big. It was unwieldy. So if you buy the paperback, there's no appendices. But if you buy the hardback, the Q&A chapter is one of those appendices, the entire text of the Q&A chapter that Hank Parkhurst wrote. And
I should have got the hardback.
And last but not least, I do a lot of these PowerPoint presentations like I did today. We didn't record this one, but the other, I've been doing a series of the history of each chapter of the Big Book. I've done four of those. I'm going to do the fifth one coming up. But somebody figured out how to record it, and we've been loading them up to YouTube. So I've got a YouTube channel of Big Book history. And if you go to YouTube and just put in Bill Shaver, the channel comes up. And there's 7 presentations there at the moment.
I think we've got link in the chat to that. And we are recording this today, Bill.
Okay. Yeah, well, it's just that the way the guy does it is it's got my slides and me talking on the right-hand side. You know what? So it's just an anonymous thing. Everybody else doesn't show up in the Hollywood Squares kind of thing. And it's not just the audio, it's also audio and visual. So that's what we got on YouTube.
Yes, thank you, Bill. I did notice the difference in the Big Book in writing style with the chapter to the employers. God, I don't think is mentioned until the very, very end, maybe once. if that, if I recall, because I haven't read the book in a while, but the writing style is different for the employers than the rest of the book.
Yes.
Bill, may I ask you one more quick question? What do you think about the way Silkworth ended his chapter with the, if you came to scoff, I hope you remain to pray?
Yeah, again, I don't think Silkworth is averse to that. I mean, I have no idea. I haven't done any research on him in terms of, did he and his wife belong to a church? I presume they did. I would be surprised if they didn't. Most professional people in the 1930s did, just for, if nothing else, for business reasons, you know? It was how you were identified. He wasn't some sort of, you know, agnostic atheist just pounding on his own agenda here. I suspect he had religious convictions that dovetailed nicely with Bill Wilson's, maybe not as strenuous as Bill Wilson's, because especially in 1935, Bill Wilson was something of a pound on the table kind of guy. So,
Thanks. Jeff, thanks for waiting. Come on in.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jeff. Thank you very much, Bill. That was a wonderful presentation. You kind of pulled together ideas that I had, you know, been thinking about, but hadn't ever been able to articulate in quite that same way. So I really appreciate that. I'm trying to find you. Oh, there you are. I'm on a cell phone, so I'm scrolling through to find you. Okay. So my question, I'm not sure. I'm struggling a little bit to formulate my exact question, but I think what it involves is, I definitely feel like for me, the fellowship and having like a tribe and a group has been a very, very important part of my sobriety. I think for a while I was involved in general service. I was a GSR and a district secretary and a DCM. And that was probably when I felt like I was the most sober, because I was the most connected to the tribe. And I would, every 3 months, we'd go to these assemblies around the state of Oregon and meet all these new people. It was a really great time. But I relapsed at a certain point. And when that happened, they said, well, you know, you can't continue to do this anymore. You have to get out of service, and you have to go back, and you have to just, you know, you can go back and you can clean ashtrays or make coffee at a meeting, but you can't be involved in any other service things. And then it made me think, you know, I've seen this same dynamic before when somebody is a kind of a, maybe like an important person in AA who's had a long time sobriety, they maybe sponsor a lot of people, and then they drink, and then like, that's it. You don't sponsor anybody else, you know, your status is like gone. And so I guess the question is something to do with, is there kind of a status hierarchy in AA within the fellowship whereby the people with the long-term sobriety are like high status individuals, and the newcomers or the people who relapse are like low status individuals? I mean, look at Hank, right? Hank was a very high status individual until he drank, and then like, okay, let's just forget about Hank. He's not important anymore. And so that's kind of what my question is about. Is that something that happens in AA, or am I just imagining things?
Jeff, I don't think you're imagining anything whatsoever. That, I mean, there's certainly a pecking order based on continuous sobriety. In my men's group, we have a anniversary night at the last Monday of the month, and we give out coins, and you don't get a coin unless your sponsor's there to give you a coin. But we're always talking about continuous sobriety. You know, God forbid somebody should have a drink after 7 years and then stay sober for 7 years. They're only sober for 7 years. They're not sober for 14 years with one shot of whiskey in the middle. You know, it's just, it's how things are done. Now, I don't think things were always done that way. I think especially there's a little bit of research been done on the people, the way they were counting in Ohio, for instance, you know, I don't think they paid as much attention to continuous. You know, if you didn't get rip roaring drunk, you just had a couple of drinks, for instance, and you had two shots of whiskey and didn't get drunk, then, well, that, you were still kind of a sober guy, I think. I don't know that much about what was going on out there at that time. But yeah, and there are people, I know there are people who really object to that. I do an AA meditation meeting 5 days a week, and I'm going to be running one of those tonight at 5 o'clock. And we got a guy in there, Tim. He's just a great guy. He's like 42 years sober. But he complains bitterly when people do the day count thing, because he thinks the day count thing just puts an added burden of pressure on people. You know, that just pressure, pressure, pressure. And he's like, "Did you drink today?" All he wants to know is, "Did you drink today?" And I really love that. I love it when people have contrary opinions, and you know, the contrary opinions appeal to me, and that's one of those that does appeal to me. But on the other hand, I mean, we had one of the women on this regular meeting I go to was coming up on 19 years and she drank. And when we finally got the whole story out of her, it turns out she'd been drinking for 4 months. But now she's back counting days. And I don't know. It's alcoholics are confusing people. There's no model that works. You know, I can't say that what works for me is going to work for you, or it's going to work for Kenji, or it's going to work for Joe. We're confusing people. Certainly there is a pecking order, though. God forbid, you know, you should. I mean, I've been sober since 1981, and I would be loath to start counting days again. Let me tell you, or to go back to the right. Beginners group at my men's group. No. Talk about fellowship keeping me sober. If I were to drink again, I'd have to go back to the beginners group at the Stratford men's group. And that would be a fate worse than death in my little universe, you know. So I'm not drinking today.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
Hey, Steve. Hi, come on in.
How you doing? Steve H., alcoholic and drug addict. I'm just love hearing all about this. I'm going out to get this book for sure. And I'm going to remember Hank. I didn't know anything about Hank until the beginning of this. Just a little quick thing. I was in AA in 1984 to 91. I came in, and the only thing that kept me there was some guy said, hey, you see that God thing up there? Don't worry about it. There's no rules in AA. And I said, good, because if there had been any, I was so screwed up back then. If had it been any God pushed on me, I was gone. I was brought up Catholic. 12 years old, I started doing drugs and drinking, and I was already going to hell as far as God was concerned. I had so many mortal sins, and I was there for 7 years. I went back out. I stopped going to meetings. I figured, okay, I'm going to be in the first alcoholic to go out, and I'll be a social drinker now. I went out for 30 years. I'm a living miracle. I've got 9.5 months in. I came into here, and I've been working like hell to hang on to this, and I have completed the 12 steps, and I am now a member of a group called The Review, and it's all anonymous. It's NA, HA, AA, everybody's there, and the word God has been taken out of that. It's higher power, whatever you want to call it. You want your higher power, you want it as a doorknob, go for it, and I've been able to grasp hold. I'm getting that book. I love it how all the young people can come in now that have all kinds of problems, never mind alcohol, but everything. And because there isn't God, they can grab onto it. And there's people now that are sober that are 25, 35 years old. Anyway, love hearing this. I'm all for it. I'm so glad AA is expanding so much as it is and becoming a whole bunch more than it ever was. And thank you very much, Bill. Appreciate it. Thank you,
Steve. Thank you. Bob. Thank you.
My name is Bob. I'm an alcoholic. And Steve was triggering me with the mortal sin talk. I had to say a brief prayer that those people don't have it right or I'm screwed. Anyway, I'm a big fan of the book. There's a saying, if your big book has fallen apart, you're probably not. Here's my copy of Mr. Shaberg's book, It's Fallen Apart. I read it a lot. It's fabulous, and I'd say that even if I wasn't in it. But the other thing I want to say is, Bill, you are the best presenter. Like, the enthusiasm comes out. This is maybe the 10th presentation I've seen of you. If I listened to my ex-wife this much, we might still be married. But anyway, it's like a college professor and just fabulous. I love it. I've heard some of this one before. There was some new stuff for me at the end, I think. But anyway, I have a sort of question. I figured out a theory some years back, even before your book, and it's confirmed for me by your book 100 times over. But my theory is, knowledge of AA history is very helpful to the agnostic, atheist, secular type of person, because the big book stories, a lot of them aren't backed up in the factuality. So there's a certain amount of myth-making. I picked that Bill was a myth-maker, apparently. And yeah, he was a crafter of parables and, you know, not the best source of AA history. And a couple of biographers said, you know, he told the gist of the story without worrying too much about the details. So I just wonder what you thought about knowledge of history and people that are of a more secular nature, if there's a connection you see. Anyway, thanks again.
Thanks, Bob. And I love that book of yours, man. It's a great book. Keep layers. Go for it. I didn't start out to really write that. I went down there because I was trying to find out how many multiliths were printed, because I had bought one at auction. I had Jimmy Burwell's copy of the multilith. And some people say 100, some people say 200, 300, 400. I was looking for an invoice and I went down there. But then I started, they opened the archive up to me and the people were really gracious at New York City. And I started finding these things that flew in the face of stories I've been told for 30 years. You know, I just kept digging. It was too good. It was too good. I think we need to get closer to the real story. I really do. I think there's a great value in that. I think there's a great value in reading Ebbie's version of the kitchen table story, which is not, it doesn't even have a kitchen table in it. And then understanding what Bill Wilson was doing when he told that story. I mean, Bill, you know, as you know, Bob, I say the point of Bill Wilson's parable about the kitchen table story, which is pared down 75 to 80% of the details are gone or changed. The point of that is very, very important and valuable. He's a parable teller and he's a myth maker. The point of the story is that the message can best be carried when one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic, one-on-one. That's the point of that story. Now, the fact that Lois was there through the whole thing and the woman who lived on the top floor as a renter was there also, you know, just confuses the hell out of that. So, boom, Bill got rid of all that stuff. But we've been treating Bill Wilson's stories as gospel truth. You know, it's Bill Wilson said, Bill, that's what Bill said. And then, of course, you get into the problem where he said contradictory things, especially in relation to dates all over the place. People go crazy trying to, because they won't give up the fact that he could have been wrong. But the guy was a myth maker. He was a parable teller. And all he was doing, he had a vision. He was trying to keep people sober. And I'm grateful he told those stories, because I'm not sure we'd all be here today if he hadn't told those stories. But I think it's time to acknowledge the fact that they're parables and they're stories. And I think that Bill always talked about the miracle. You know, there was a miracle that this and a miracle. We could have gone off the rails. It was a miracle here, a miracle there. I think the human story told in my book is much more miraculous than all those stories Bill Wilson ever told. And I don't know how anybody could read that book and not come to that conclusion, but that's certainly how I read it.
Rosalind, come on in.
Hi, everyone. Thank you very much for an excellent meeting. My name is Rosalind and I'm alcoholic. Not really a question. I want to thank everybody for the secular approach, Bill. I actually got your book on Kindle just the last few days. How coincidental is this? But I really want to say that I know it might sound like an excuse or whatever, but I'm sober now 3.5 years. I do traditional AA, but I first went in 1991 in a desperate mess as a young woman just of 30. And I have to say the God thing just drove me to the door over and over again. Every time I went back, I was desperate. And then I would hear something and it was this, you know, you're not going to get sober without a God and all of the rest of it. And 3.5 years ago, it turned out I was traveling in Turkey. I went to an AA meeting there, again, desperate. And for the first time in my life, you'll probably have picked up from the accent, I'm Irish. It's very religious over here. The fellowship is riddled with it, as I would say. Anyway, in that far distant place, I was talking about my difficulties and a gentleman then shared that he was atheist and that he had been sober for 22 years. And I, in my naivety, didn't realize that such a thing was possible. It was a revelation to me. Anyway, to cut a very long story short, it was a married man. He agreed to be my sponsor and has taken me through, you know, very He was the one that recommended your book, Bill. And I feel very fortunate that I came across him, because the traditional people were saying you can't get sober without the God. And you used the word incendiary. And I have to say, it's part of my story. And I do share at the physical meetings that I have got sober as an atheist. And I can't tell you the number of times that somebody will take me aside after the meeting to be saying, you really shouldn't be sharing about that, you know, blah, blah. I basically get told off. So I just wanted to share that. But I feel that as part of my experience, if I was driven out, that there may well be other people, as you said, it's a terrible grief and a terrible heartbreak that, you know, people are missing the miracle of recovery and the joy of the fellowship because of, you know, dogmatism and people thinking that they're right. So I don't mean to be incendiary at meetings, but I do feel, I mean, even when I speak about that now, I can feel my wee heart racing, how important it was for me to hear those words, that you can get sober. There are alternative ways of doing it. And the explanation about getting it maybe back to front about the spiritual awakening, that's something I'm going to give an awful, a really, really deep thought to as I go through your book, because that's the way that it worked for me. Not a spiritual awakening in any sort of, you know, Damascus sense, but, you know, to get sober, so I would have been 59. And for the first time in my life, to feel that sense of connection, you know, that was a spiritual awakening that was enough for me. So it wasn't really a question. It was just to thank you. I think it's absolutely amazing. I can't wait now to dive into this book that, and I'm going to get the hardback version. And, you know, it's, I don't mean to be challenging other people, and some people are very, very uncomfortable with my stance, but, you know, I can't be the only one here in Derry in Northern Ireland that doesn't believe in a God, and I was desperate to get sober. And it's not going to happen until you go on your knees, and it's not going to happen until you believe. And the number of times I walked out of AA meetings, you know, heading for another drink, thinking I am absolutely doomed because I don't believe, I can't believe. I was raised Catholic, happened to be Mormon for 7 years. I did the whole religious thing. I'm now atheist. And sorry, I don't mean to go on about this, but one wee thing, I wonder if you can identify with this. A lot of people have suggested to me that I'm intellectually arrogant in claiming to be atheist. And I can share here that when I lost my faith in God, it was and remains one of the biggest heartbreaks of my life, the day that I realized that everything I had believed before wasn't right. You know, so it's not an arrogance. It was a great grief in my life. I've come to terms with it now and it's fine. But it wasn't from a position of arrogance. It came to me, you know, just in an understanding that my previous beliefs had been faulty. So wonderful work. I'm so excited to come across in my recent sobriety so many people in the secular recovery work. And I'm very grateful for it. And I intend to join more on Zoom. I'll still do my physical meetings because of the sense of community and to do some service and all of that. But to get more involved with the opportunities that have been given to me here today online. And, you know, thank you for doing that work. Thank you for doing it. And I'm just so excited to actually meet you in person. Thank you.
Thank you, Rosalind. Thank you.
Hi there, Daniel. Come on in.
Hey, thank you, Kenji. Bill, first and foremost, I want to say thank you for the tremendous effort, research, and then the way that you effectively communicated, especially like starting with chapter one. But I just wanted to simply say thank you first. I've read it twice. I've got it on my desk, even though my job has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. I keep it on the desk as a reference. both when people call that may be interested in AA history, we can have conversations and talk about it. I've got friends that have been interested in it. My home state, Little Rock, Arkansas, got to host the National Archives Workshop this year, and they had a title for the conference, Does AA History Carry the Message? And it was subtitled, You Bet It Does. And I think your book does a great job of carrying the message and helping us get down to what your stated goal was, to finding out what really was going on in that time period. Because that can help inform us and then improve Alcoholics Anonymous. So it makes us better to know the truth, as opposed to maybe a story that is a massaged version of something. So that always helps me. One thing I wanted to ask, or first, I also wanted to say thank you very much for publishing the Q&A chapter. I don't, and I also recommended your book to several people that were putting on the Archives Conference that did not know about it. So it was a great opportunity for that. And I want to thank you for the Q&A chapter. I'd heard of it in years past, but don't know that I've ever seen it published anywhere else. So it was fascinating. I thumbed to that first when I found out that was in there after reading the table of contents. That was really, really interesting to see. Another thing, you expanded on some stuff in the book, specifically about Hank P. Probably being more of a deist, I think you had described him as and come to in your research. And you've talked about some about Jim Burwell and the impact, you know, I guess he was kind of the early hellraiser. And his story is loosely outlined in the third tradition in the 12 and 12, but called Ed somebody. But anyhow, I wondered if you come across anything in your research. I've been interested in finding out the fates of the people, like following up the case histories of the people in the first edition in the stories. I think there were 29 stories. I could be wrong on that number exactly. But in one of Jim Burwell's talks, he references that there were 6 suicides of those 29. I didn't know if that was something that you had ever come across, or maybe you could point me in the direction of following up where I could follow up and find out more about those case histories.
Yeah, Daniel, I've never done that research. You know, the 11 years of research I did was confined primarily to October 37 to April of 39. I was just 18 months, you know, and there was just so much. Now, once you go past April of 39, all of a sudden the documentation starts piling up in New York, and it's stepping stones. So there's even more stuff down there. But no, I just really, really don't know. I know there's a couple of lists floating around. If you email me, I might be able to send you. John Barton Scott sent me a list. They did a recap of people in New Jersey, for instance, how many people were sober and who they were in New Jersey in January of 1940 or whatever the hell it was. But I don't know. I haven't heard about. I thought I'd listen to all of Jimmy's talks. I don't remember him ever saying 6 people committed suicide. But who knows? But Jimmy's wildly inaccurate on so much stuff. He's like, you know, you got to find a second source for anything Jimmy says, because he's just. I mean, I did a presentation one time where I put his evolution of AA up, and I highlighted all the mistakes in yellow. You know, on PowerPoint slide after PowerPoint slide, I was impressed with how bad he was, you know, when I finished doing that. So, but yeah, if I've got something, I've only got bits and pieces, you know, but no, I haven't heard anything about the suicides. So can't be helpful. Sorry.
You think that's due to memory problems or intentional retelling his way?
I don't really know. He just got so much stuff wrong. I mean, completely wrong. I don't know. Was he brain dead on some level that, you know, he just couldn't do? I don't know. I really don't know what that was all about. But that evolution of AA that he wrote in 1947, 1948 is just a travesty. It's just a travesty of bad information. And by the way, if you've got a question for me, if you go to my website, writingthebigbook.com, there's a way you can send me a question there, or you can just send me at my email address is bill@athenararebooks.com. That's my business. Thanks.
Thanks. Jared, hi. Come on in.
Thanks, Kenji. And thanks, Bill. Fascinating stuff. My name's Jared. I'm an alcoholic addict. I wholeheartedly agree with you about the amazingness of the fellowship of AA. StatsCan just released that's Stats Canada, just released their 2001 census. And it says that the amount of people who identify as non-religious now is up to close to 35%. I think it's 34.6. That's over a third of us now who don't have a religious affiliation. And apparently in the US, it's just shy of 30% now. That's doubled in the past 20 years in Canada. I'm not a big fan of organized religion, and that's an understatement. But I think that one of the biggest, or maybe the only, benefit of organized religion is the sense of fellowship that it gives people. And you have proven there that fellowship is so important for us humans. I'm so grateful to have found AA and the fellowship that it provides. I wish that all of my loved ones could find AA, but damn, they're not all alcoholics. So what's your thought on how do people find this fellowship? Because I don't think there's many fellowships as strong as AA out there to find. So if you're, I don't love the term normie, but I'll use it anyway. If you're someone who does not suffer from addiction or alcoholism, how do we go about finding this fellowship that's so important for us?
Jared, that's an awesome question, but I honestly don't know. I agree. In my experience in life, I'm 79 years old. I've never seen anything like Alcoholics Anonymous in terms of the intensity of the fellowship that's available there. I mean, there are churches that are really, really good. We got a local church here that's, I mean, in my opinion, it's a real Christian church. There, I mean, those people are doing outreach and they're working on all kinds of different levels. And they let AA meetings come in there. Those are great, great, great people. But I know people that belong to that church and belong and are activists in that church. And they got nothing like I got in my life. You know, my wife, the lady Sarah, she's been sober 37 years next week. And you know, she cooked dinner for 10 people every Monday night for 30 years before the COVID thing shut it down. And 10 people came to our house every single Monday night before they split up and went to their men's and women's meetings. You know, just where the hell do you get that outside of Alcoholics Anonymous? I don't know anybody who does that, you know? And of course, the people on our street can't figure out why the hell all those cars were showing up every Monday night. And well, the people, we had an AA open house until COVID hit. You know, people coming through here all the time. So I have a bunch of friends who aren't alcoholics who get a good, serious glimpse into my life and the community that I live in, and they're envious. They sit me down and they tell me how envious they are, and they wish they could have something like that, but they don't have a drinking problem. So, I think we are just completely blessed people. I mean, the riches of my life because of the number of people that are in my life, the men that I sponsor. I have two sponsors, the sponsors that I have, the meetings that I go to with real regularity. I can go on and on. Nobody I know outside of AA has anything. You know, I go on walks and there's dog walkers out there. And I, you know, people I sit, and there's a woman I talk to all the time. And this woman is so lonely. She's so disconnected. She's so isolated. She and her dog, you know, God. How painful is that? How painful is that? You know, and it's just, I can't just say, you know, why don't you come to a meeting? Anyhow, we are blessed, but you got to get in and do it. You got to show up. You got to take the phone calls. You got to make the phone calls. You got to go to the meetings. You got to send, you know, help people whenever you can. Do whatever you can. Be involved in those people's lives. So, yeah.
Thanks. Rady, hi.
Hi, Kenji. Hi. Thank you, Bill, very much. I own the book, I'm happy to say. Haven't read all of it, but I loved the title, your title, and I have a question on that because in the history, I'm from Cleveland, and so we all learned the history of when Clevelanders left the Akron-Oxford group in 1939. See, you say the creation of AA, which is, I see that AA began, I thought, in like June of 1939, when the first meeting called itself a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was in Cleveland. It was the Borton group. A month or two later, the Orchard Grove group started in Cleveland. So to me, and they were also called the drunk squad of the Oxford group or the alcoholic squad, depending on the audience. And so they really weren't called AA until 1939, but then which is how I see when you say the creation of AA, I agree totally. It was when the book was published. But then you just brought up a fact I didn't know, that Bill, the New York group, left the Oxford group in 1937. Yes. It's probably in your book. I probably didn't get there that far.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, you're a Cleveland person. Of course, you think it was the first meeting in Cleveland that was the foundation of Oxford. people in Akron all think it was June 6th of 19. And I've actually done a presentation where I take all these different facts of the American Revolution, you know, the Boston Tea Party and blah, 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 all this stuff, all the way down to the Declaration of Independence, and then beyond that, you know, into the Constitution, all that stuff. But then I go all the same things. There's all these things that happen in AA, you know, Ebby sees Bill, Ebby gets sober, Roland Hazard talks to Dr. Jung. There's all this laundry list of stories. But my point when I do that presentation is the most important date in the American Revolution thing is the Declaration of Independence Day, July 4th, 1776, because after that, everything changed and you couldn't go back again. Everything changed, you couldn't go back again. And the same thing, in my opinion, I know I'm a very minority opinion here, that the foundational day of Alcoholics Anonymous was April 10th, 1939, the day the book was published, because all along, before that, we could have lost the whole, we could have gone off the rails. But once that book was published, everything changed and there was no going back. There was only going forward. So,
and, you know, Bill or Dr. Bob's sobriety date could not have been June 10th.
Oh, please. I know all about that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. All right. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Marilyn. Hi.
Hey, thank you for letting me share. I'm an adult child of alcoholism and craziness, and I have been in Al-Anon for over 3 decades, and I just want to really thank Bill for this book. It has really helped me understand where the program came from, a friend or relative point of view, what was going on when this all got started. And I know you're calling Bill a myth maker, storyteller. I call him a salesman. My dad was a salesman. And he could sell something. And Bill was selling this. He was selling this book. I tell my sponsees, these guys were broke. I said, Bill had help writing this book. You know, it gets represented as such an icon, and it is an icon, okay? But I mean, it gets represented as more than it is. And even Bill, after 20 years, you know, when he wrote his essay, Emotional Sobriety, which really describes recovery to me, for all of us, we are all looking for emotional sobriety. And that poor woman on that bench, I wish you'd recommend Al-Anon to her, because we, you know, we're the same way. I depend on the fellowship of Al-Anon. I'm one of the original members of one of the few secular Al-Anon groups in the country. And we went online during the pandemic, and we have registered electronically. We're a registered Al-Anon group because we do not read the steps out loud. That's kind of how we get around it. We named our group Any Faith or None, which is straight out of the Al-Anon preamble to the 12 steps. And we take them at their word. We don't recommend any religious or religiosity. And we let people kind of sound off about the God word and stuff, but they come back and they, you know, they feel welcome. We watched a lot of young people walking out of our meeting. We're in a college town, and, you know, finally talked to a few of them and they said, oh, it's too religious. You know, even Al-Anon, and even here, it's not as religious as other places. But anyway, I got into recovery before religion was there just wasn't the pressure of religiosity. And I was in a small rural town. And so, but I was in at the beginning of people figuring out how to recover as an adult child of an alcoholic. So I saw a lot of struggles then, and I kind of feel like secular recovery is similar to what adult children and alcoholics went through. And we're going to find our way. We're finding each other. It's going to become acceptable because of mass, the pressure of the masses. And I believe that as long as we're welcoming to anyone of any religious faith or none, we just use the fellowship, those of us that want to express it the way we want to express it are in the majority. And we get more buy-in from others that way. So, and not that we're looking for buy-in, we're offering serenity. That's what we're looking for. And I just appreciate your book. I wish a more realistic book about Lois was out there. And yeah, so that's about all I have to say. And I admire your book. I have it on Audible. I listen to it beginning to end. All the footnotes are on my Audible. And I just had that book playing for days and days. So I'll get the hard copy so I can underline in it. But anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marilyn. Thank you.
Bill, did that laughter mean that you are buying into taking on your next project that's writing a no. history of Lois?
No. But you know, talk about mythologies. Okay, we're going to leave it at that. I mean, no. No, in my age, you know, people keep saying I should write the Hank Parker's book, and it's like 10 years of research. I don't have 10 years left in me, so I'm not doing that. But somebody should be doing that. Neil.
Yeah, Bob Kay should write the Hank Parker's book. He's got plenty of time. I just want to thanks for your presentation. I read the book. That's the only book I've ever bought before it came out. I had a lot of fun in the beginning because some of the I won't name the Facebook groups, but you know, there's some groups up there where they know everything about everything. And I used a lot of this stuff in that book, and these people are like, how does this guy know this stuff? You know, because they'd never heard of your book. And I'm sure everybody has now, but when I gave them some details, they're just like, how does this guy know this stuff? I heard the Jim Burwell. I heard him talk about the six suicides. That was a long time ago. But like you said, he's just a little bit, more than a little bit, you know, out there. I think maybe Florence committed suicide, but I don't know that they're even sure about that. Up there, I got a couple of friends in Cleveland, and they'll tell you that Clarence Snyder started AA, you know.
Yeah.
It's just whatever you're told.
We have a book. Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. This is from okay.
Yeah, I've read all the AA books and all the history books, and there's so much stuff out there, and there's so much stuff that's just way off. I mean, you know, I haven't done the research. I wish somebody would write the Hank Parkhurst book. It's really a fascinating dude to me. And anyway, that's all I got. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Neil. You know, there's just a ton of stuff. My friends, Bill Cleveland and Jay Stennett were here for a week, for a few days, maybe a month ago. And we went up to Brown University and we were poking around. I found a whole bunch of Hank Parker's letters from the mid 40s that I had never seen before. And fortunately, those people let you take pictures. You know, you can't copy anything at GSO. You can't copy anything at the Stepping Stones archive. You have to type it up. So, I mean, I spent weeks and spent months in the GSO office typing up all those documents that were there. But people at Brown let you copy them. So I've got some people working on transcribing them now, and hopefully we'll get them up on the, there's a Hank Parkhurst website, by the way. It's in progress, but it's hankparkhurst.com. And friends started that thing, and I've submitted some stuff to it, and we're going to get some more of these letters up. I think I've got 12 new letters from the 1940s between him and Clarence Snyder, you know, and they're just, some of them are just really a rip, man. He's just like, Snyder, I'm not putting up with this crap anymore from you, and just wonderful. I'll get them up there soon. But anyhow, yeah, if you haven't seen the Hank Parkhurst website, it's a work in progress, hankparkhurst.com, and it's we're going to get it done.
Bill, can you tell us a little bit about your home group? Is that the Stratford Men's Group? Is that a traditional meeting?
That's a traditional meeting. Yeah. Well, actually, it's four different meetings. If you're less than 6 months, you go to the beginner's room, and then there's a step meeting, and then there's two discussion groups. But I've really, over COVID, Lady Sarah and I were going to a local AA meditation meeting on Tuesdays and Fridays. And when COVID hit, we started going there, and they had a Zoom meeting. And at the moment, we've expanded. It used to be 4 days a week. Now it's 7 days a week. And I've been doing that for 2.5 years. So I've been to my old home group a couple of times, but I got to tell you, I'm really liking this group that we've got on Zoom. And there's a couple of reasons for that. We get 30, give or take a couple of people. We get 30 people every day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. And then on 10 o'clock on Saturdays and 5 p.m. on Sundays. And I realized when I went back to my men's meeting that what I really liked about this meeting was that it was only one third men. If there was 30 people on the meeting, there was 10 men. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I was just my home group. I was definitely missing this feminine influence that I've become very, very, very enamored of. And so when I went back to my high testosterone meeting, I found it repulsive on some levels. So I'm not really going to that meeting after 38 years of going to that meeting. I'm not really going to that meeting anymore. The other cool thing about the meeting I'm going to a lot is that there's always 10, let's say 10 out of 30 men. There's also 10 out of 30 people are 30 years or more sobriety. Although we got a couple of newcomers at the moment. So that's really great. You know, but I love being on a meeting with people who've been sober a long time, who are still really serious about making changes in their life, about enlarging their spiritual life, whatever the hell that means to them. You know, somebody was talking before about people being negative when you start saying you're an atheist or you're an agnostic. I've been doing that all my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I've gone through a bunch of different stuff on that. But, you know, when people get in my face, I say to people, you know, it's about a spiritual awakening. You need a spiritual awakening. And the best thing I ever heard about that was a guy who on an AA tape said was, identify the places where you encounter the spiritual. Identify the places where you encounter the spiritual and go there often. One of the best pieces of advice I was ever given in my entire life. Because my spiritual places aren't your spiritual places. But if I get it up on my radar, all of a sudden I start, that qualifies. That's a spiritual place. That's a spiritual place.
And last question. Do you attend meetings that are secular other than when you're invited to come and be the speaker?
No, not particularly. I've been a 4-meeting-a-week guy my whole sobriety, sometimes 5. And at the moment I'm 5 and I'm doing all these Zoom AA meditation, the same group that we're with. And talk about fellowship, man, those people are just, we have one of those young women where I'm in Connecticut. Most of the people are in, but we have people from Florida and people from California in this group. But one of the young women was in Queens, New York, and she had a lot of medical problems, you know, and the women in this group were getting in the car and driving down there and, you know, spending a couple of hours with her and doing, I was just amazed at the depth of commitment to fellowship that this group has. Which was always true of my men's group too. You know, I mean, you know, when my parents died, I mean, 75, 80 of those guys came to those wakes. You know, you go to wakes. That's what you do. I think I've been to 2 wakes before I got sober. And I was like, I went to like 5 my first year. It's like, what the hell are we doing? Oh, we're going to the wake. That's what we're doing. Because you show up for people. That's just what you do. So no, I don't go to any secular meetings.
Any closing thoughts, anyone? Okay, thanks so much, Bill, for coming and sharing with us today.
Thank you, Kenji. I really appreciate it. It was fun. And thank you guys for all the good questions. I appreciate that too. So good.